centre in a London branch of the retail chain Marks & Spencer. After health checks, recruits joined the Haganah or the Elite Palmach or Strike Force, both of which committed many atrocities against civilians, including castration. One of the youngest recruits from Britain was the internationally known hairdresser Vidal Sassoon, seen here in Palestine in 1948. The far-right terror militias like the Stern Gang and the Ergun were also active in Britain and dispatched perhaps 40 British recruits to the terror in Palestine. The Ergun recruited via a mass poster campaign under the cover name of the Jewish Legion, led by Major Samuel Weiser, the deeply racist public face of the group. All of the groups committed atrocities, including massacres of civilians. The atrocities have been covered up ever since by intimidations, ideology, and lies. Alternatively, the past has simply been erased by the destruction of Palestinian villages and their replacement with forests created by the Zionist Jewish National Fund. One even has the Orwellian title of Peace Forest and has been expanded in recent years via the demolition of Palestinian homes in Silwan, East Al-Quds. Shockingly, some are named after the countries from which funding for the ethnic cleansing has come, such as the British Park or the Canada Park. There are dozens of charities in the UK, US and Canada raising money to further the ongoing ethnic cleansing being committed by the settler movement with the support of the military and government. For example, the British Friends of Ariel University raises funds for a university built entirely on an illegal settlement. According to the UN, settlement construction is a war crime. A director of the charity, Benjamin Pearl, lives in Hendon, London. He currently faces no pressure to withdraw from his collaboration with war crimes. Here he is, pictured with four Conservative MPs. The history calls for a response in Palestine and elsewhere to shut down and dismantle the institutions responsible for the ongoing Nakba.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Dr. Garda Carmi. Dr. Carmi was born in Jerusalem, but her family was forced out of their home by Zionist colonists in 1948 when she was still a baby. The family moved to England in 1949, where she grew up and was educated. She practiced as a medical doctor for many years and has held a number of research appointments on Middle Eastern politics and culture. And she's a former research fellow at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter. Welcome to the show. Garda, I wonder if I could start with you. I mean, you've lived through that, and perhaps you could just give us the benefit of your reflections after all this time and all that suffering and the fact that people are still resisting.
Well, yes, of course, it's May the 15th. Will be the anniversary of the establishment of the State of Israel. Indeed, we were victims of that establishment. And I tell you, we were luckier than most because we got away to Damascus, where my grandparents lived. Many people didn't have that, and they became refugees instantly, and eventually the UN got them into refugee camps, which are still standing today. Now, in our own case, the shock and the trauma of that departure remained with my parents all their lives, I think. It was one of the reasons why they never talked about the time in Palestine. We didn't grow up with stories of, you know, when we did this and when we did that. They didn't want to talk about it. Yeah. And it's a terribly sad that in the end they wouldn't go. They wouldn't go, although I remember arguing that our country is still there. It's occupied by other people, but it's still there. They couldn't bear it. The idea that strangers were walking those streets pretending that they were natives was beyond them.
No,
so it's been really difficult. It's a terribly sad, tragic event which has not been sufficiently understood, not only by people outside but by Palestinians themselves. Because I think the trauma was so profound, It's taken decades to try and come to terms with it.
Well, we'll come to how the history has been concealed a little later in the programme. But David, I mean, people from Britain, British people went over to participate in the ethnic cleansing, didn't they, back then?
Yes, it's amazing. I mean, this is something which has been buried from history. You can read it if you read in detail all the historical accounts of the period. Marks and Spencer's had a secret recruitment centre for the Haganah to recruit militias to go and expel the Palestinians. And indeed, there was an anti-fascist group in London, the 43 group, which went over altogether to the Ergun, the far-right revisionist Zionist terror group. And they sent about 40 people to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians. People don't know that. These were British Jews who went to shoot and to kill and to expel the Palestinians. A truly shameful part of British history, which people have forgotten.
No, indeed. And people go in, many people from this country, many people from London went there and indeed came back. Came back here, you know, obviously after they'd participated in this ethnic cleansing. I mean, do you know whether any of them faced any sanctions for that? And indeed, have you ever come face to face with any of those people that participated in the Nakba?
No, they never came. They were never the object of sanctions at all. And that, of course, has been the story of Israel. Total impunity. Nobody ever holds Israel accountable and its supporters accountable for the tragedy of Palestine. No, indeed, they were never made accountable. Fortunately, I didn't come across any of those people, but I tell you, what I came across was 1967 when Israel invaded and occupied the rest of historic Palestine. The number of Jews in this country, British Jews, who were prepared to go out to that area and fight on the side of Israel was phenomenal. And I well remember a grocer in Golders Green, where ironically enough my family lived, and I remember saying to him, why are you, he says, my shop will be closed because I'm off to Israel to help out. So I said, why are you doing that? He said, because we are under attack. Mm. And I was so struck by that. We? Who's we? Mm. This man was English, was a British person, as far as I knew.
Yes.
That was the kind of thing that went on.
No, indeed. And I just wanted to maybe ask you, David. I mean, Vidal Sassoon passed away 10 years ago, actually, commemorated his anniversary of his death, I think, was commemorated recently by a prominent member of the Jewish Socialist Group. I just wondered what your thoughts were on what that says about how the Nakba is actually remembered in this country.
Yeah, and this was a guy called David Rosenberg. Yeah. He's a supporter of Palestinian rights. But he remembered the death of Vidal Sassoon for his involvement in the 43 group, an alleged anti-fascist group from the 1940s. Now, what's extraordinary about that is that Sassoon, as we saw in the film there, travelled to Palestine. He was in the Palmach, the elite strike force of the Haganah, and he said that was the making of his life. He would, participating in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine was an experience which stayed with him for the rest of his life. Now, what on earth are socialists, Jewish or otherwise, doing celebrating someone who participated in ethnic cleansing? This is a truly extraordinary thing. It says a lot about the way in which even pro-Palestinian people have a blind spot on the role of Zionism in our history.
Yes. I mean, I'm turning, if I can, Garda, to you about the ongoing Nakba. I mean, we see the regular incursions at the Al-Aqsa, the demolitions, the brutality, the murders, the killings that are carried out on a routine basis. I mean, what do you think that says about the current situation?
Well, first of all, remember that the war against the Palestinian people that Israel waged started in 1948 and before, and it was the aim of it was erasure. This is important for people to understand. The aim of the Zionists was to erase the fact that there had ever been anything called Palestine, or a native population called Palestinians, who had their own culture, their own customs, their own society. There was a ferocious attack on the history and the culture of the Palestinian people. And that started from, as I say, 1948 and before. Now, that's continued. So it's an ongoing process under which Israel has felt able to expel more Palestinians, take the case in Jerusalem's Sheikh Jarrah area, where people are fighting to stay in their homes, even now, and almost losing the battle. So it's an ongoing attack. And as for killings, just a few days ago, the Palestinian journalist, Shireen, yes, Abu Aqla, who is a marvelous woman who had been doing her job when the Israelis shot her and killed her in the Jenin area. This is a very, very big enemy to fight, really. And when you earlier asked me how come the Palestinians are still standing on their feet, that is in itself truly remarkable.
It is.
Because this enemy is multi-headed. It's like a hydra. It's not just what we see in the shape of the Israeli army, but it's also the extended pro-Israel lobbies, the Jewish supporters of Palestine, even socialist Jews, as we've just heard, cannot stop themselves from being sympathetic
and
to Israel.
And further to that, David, I mean, we've got charities, haven't we, supporting, I mean, for example, Oriel University, based on an illegal settlement, supported by a charity, a British charity. I don't know, is that widespread? I mean, how is this happening? I mean, British charity supporting what effectively a kind of war crimes.
It's not one charity. There is one charity which supports the university. There's another charity which supports the settlement itself. And there are scores of charities in this country which are devoted to illegal settlements, to war crimes, to supporting
war crimes. Yeah.
And they're allowed by the Charity Commission to be charities because they say that they have public benefit. It's not a public benefit to commit war crimes in occupied territory occupied by the State of Israel. Mm. And so there's a real issue here, is that there's no pushback against this in this country. And these are organizations which should be dismantled. The people who are involved in them should potentially be considered for being accessories to war crimes. So, yet they walk around our streets without any pushback.
Indeed. Well, I mean, that's certainly something that we need to take up beyond this show for sure. But we're just going to have to leave it there, if we can, because we've got another report now coming up to look at how Zionist lobby groups are censoring and distorting Palestinian history.
After eliminating the Palestinians from Palestine in the Nakba, the apartheid entity is acting through proxies in the UK and US to erase traces of the Nakba and the Palestinians' heroic freedom struggle from the pages of school textbooks. In Britain, they've used proxy groups, the Board of Deputies, which has a, quote, close working relationship with the Israeli embassy, and UK Lawyers for Israel, which works with the Israeli Foreign Ministry to edit textbooks. In a report on their efforts by the British Middle East specialist, it was found that the lobby groups carried out hundreds of changes, an average of three per page. In the first version of the textbook, Jewish terrorism was mentioned 10 times and Palestinian terrorism 32 times. Following the lobby intervention, there were only 4 references to Jewish terrorism and 61 to Palestinian terrorism. The report found the edits were not simply more pro-Israel than their original versions, but dangerously misleading. Henry Maitlis, Emeritus Professor of Education at the University of the West of Scotland, stated that the books are now in danger of being seen as propaganda. The team of pro-Israel propagandists that worked on the edits was the Board of Deputies International Relations Officer, who identifies herself as Israeli, Talia Ingleby, and Suzanne Storing, Richard Millett, Jonathan Turner, and Caroline Turner of the UK Lawyers for Israel. In the US, the situation is markedly worse, with an actual Israel lobby group parading as a benign educational body. The Institute for Curriculum Services claims to have influenced the US education system in 50 states and impacted the studies of 11 million students. It's also hosted workshops in 90 U.S. cities, with over 6,000 teachers participating. The changes ICS has requested include replacing the word settlers with communities, deleting the word Palestine and replacing it with Judah, changing the phrase Jews settled there to Jews joined those Jews already there. It even suggested removing an exercise to write an unbiased essay on the issue of West Bank settlements. It has also requested the deletion of references to Palestinian cultural heritage and tried to change school maps to include illegally occupied lands as part of Israel. The ICS is a project of the Jewish Community Relations Councils, a charity it uses to protect itself. It also receives money from the Schusterman Family Foundation, which also supports a project of the notorious Israel lobby group AIPAC. We can reveal that the deputy director of the Institute for Curriculum Services, Bella Ben-Sack, formerly worked for the Israeli Ministry of Tourism. Also, Rick Brody, a former analyst at ICS, was previously employed at Birthright, the Israeli operation to encourage Jewish children to become colonists. So here we have proxies of the Zionist regime working to mislead children in Britain and what they learn about the ongoing Nakba.
David, there seems to be a concerted effort by the Zionist lobby to rewrite history, doesn't there?
Well, there is. I mean, Gara was talking about this earlier and saying it's been in operation since 1948 at least. But I think the thing to recognise here is that they still need to do this. They haven't succeeded in doing it. They have been successful in many ways, but they haven't succeeded in erasing the alternative narrative, which is the truth about what happened in Palestine, the occupation.
I mean, Agata, I know that you've pushed back against these Zionist falsifications, haven't you? I wonder if you could maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I really hope David is right, that we are still, our version is still pushing through, because my anxiety is this campaign to erase Palestine from history and from the map is pretty sophisticated, and it's run by totally dedicated zealots who will stop at nothing, it seems, to demolish every idea that that Palestinians ever existed or they had any kind of culture, etc., etc. So it really worries me, this. It's utterly pernicious, and it's a very you can see why the Zionists have opted for that. Because if you can distort the story from the beginning and you influence school children, then they grow up with this pro-Israel bias and ignoring the Palestinians. So we made a group as part of BRICUP, which is this British Committee for the Universities of Palestine. We tried to, and we took on some key textbooks for children on the Middle East. I can report a success in that endeavor because the publisher, Pearson, was so flustered by our counterattack, the way we demonstrated by studying the texts that had been altered by the Zionists. We were able to point out to them the kind of falsifications that had entered into it. They've actually withdrawn their textbooks. Mm. So that was really a little success.
Yeah,
but it's ongoing. They've got the European Union now trying to alter, to forbid certain textbooks from being taught. I think in the same sense as David is saying, we're still around, that they always have to think of how to damage us in the next step. The trouble is they're still around.
Yes.
From my point of view, they're still around.
Well, David, tell us about this US-based group that's attempting to distort history.
Well, it's more sophisticated than some others. And so, I mean, I think Gareth's right that there is a sophistication here in that it's part of a charity, so it pretends to be a charitable foundation only interested in educational matters, and it uses that charity to defend itself. It's a kind of shield against criticism and against the idea that it's actually an Israel lobby group, which of course it is. So that's a kind of more sophisticated strategy than they've been using, for example, in the UK, where where they've put in lobby groups like the Board of Deputies or the UK Lawyers for Israel, which is a really extreme far-right pro-Israel lobby group, and that exposes them quite a lot. So it's been more successful, but it's now being exposed, and there's some pushback against it, and it's good to see that. We see the pushback, I think, in part because the resistance remains in Palestine, and that is that's the lodestar of these kind of debates. I mean, we see these things happening in the UK and the US, but if it wasn't for the resistance in Palestine, these would be much less successful, I think. Right. So I think that's the thing to watch. When the resistance is successful in Palestine, then we will see the debates in the UK and the US and Canada and elsewhere will be won toot sweet.
I mean, God, the attempt to distort history, the propagandizing is kind of, it's nothing new. I wonder whether you could say, I mean, what do you think that says about the current situation? And indeed, what more could people do perhaps to resist and to push back against these distortions, these propagandizing, which we see the Zionist lobby indulging in, which they seem to get quite a lot of support, from the corporate media, don't they?
They do. But, the first step in all this is to understand and appreciate the size of the assault on the Palestinians. I think a number of activists and supporters tend to underestimate the skills and the malevolence of the other side. It has to be understood that in order to defend and support this Zionist apartheid state that is called Israel, in order to keep it going, it has an army of warriors and soldiers everywhere, supporting it, defending it, etc. So that's, you understand the size of the enemy. Now, having done that, we must be not only vigilant, but constant in our efforts to counter it and to be actually even proactive. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that I have had with the solidarity movements for Palestine and the Palestinians themselves is that they are reactive. They need to be much more proactive. Yeah. They have to look at the chinks in the armor of Israel and try and exploit and get in through those chinks, so that we're doing a proper fight back, not just the defense.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, both of you, because unfortunately we've run out of time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Plans to shred parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol would send headlines around the world that the UK is prepared to break treaties. Ireland's Foreign Minister Simon Coveney has said as a British Cabinet Minister insisted the United Kingdom did not intend to break the law. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Jessica Elgott and Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled, Ireland says UK risks sending message it will break treaties in Brexit row. Plans to shred parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol would send headlines around the world that the United Kingdom is prepared to break treaties, Ireland's Foreign Minister Simon Coveney has said, as a British cabinet minister insisted the United Kingdom did not intend to break the law. The business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, said the UK had the right to act in a sovereign way and to reopen or re-examine the Northern Ireland Protocol, but denied the actions would constitute a breach of international laws. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has travelled to Belfast on Monday, and he promised not to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol negotiated as part of the Brexit deal, and he says he's only seeking reform that has the broadest possible cross-community support. In a move to put pressure back on parties at Stormont, Boris Johnson urged them to get back to work after the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, blocked the election of a speaker at the Stormont Assembly on Friday, meaning the Assembly is currently unable to function. Signs that the British government was rowing back its rhetoric on the Northern Ireland Protocol came amid mixed messaging over a trade war, with Boris Johnson allies claiming he had a conciliatory call with Ireland's Taoiseach last week. However, the Irish Times on Saturday reported Irish sources describing it as the single worst call he has ever had with anyone. On Sunday, the Irish Foreign Minister Simon Coveney criticised sabre-rattling and grandstanding from ministers over the past week, including reported plans by the UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss on Tuesday for a bill that would unilaterally override parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol in order to lift checks on goods crossing the Irish Sea. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already been warned that dozens of Conservative MPs will attempt to stop the bill becoming law if it reaches the later stages, though many see it as a negotiating tactic. The Irish Foreign Minister Simon Coveney told Sophie Ridge on Sky News on Sunday that the behaviour of UK ministers was creating a lot of tension in my country, your closest neighbour, and also potentially being on the verge of making a decision that could fundamentally undermine the functioning of the institutions of the peace process in Northern Ireland. Coveney said the majority of people in Northern Ireland were in favour of the Northern Ireland Protocol. There is a minority, a large minority within unionism, who are unhappy with the protocol, he said. There are solutions that we can put in place that can ease the concerns, and that's what we need to focus on doing together, as opposed to the British government acting on its own, illegally, in a way that doesn't reflect majority opinion in Northern Ireland, and perhaps most importantly, sends a message to the world that the British government, when it suits them, will set aside international law. He said that the relations between Britain and Ireland were being fundamentally damaged because of unhelpful briefings that we're getting from very, very senior levels within the British government this week. Simon Coveney said the European Union had not threatened any specific retaliation, though several European parliamentarians, MEPs, have said there will be consequences, including the potential suspension of the trade deal, should the British government act unilaterally. There's no way the European Union can compromise if the United Kingdom is threatening unilateral action to pass domestic legislation to set aside international obligations under an international treaty that, don't forget, the United Kingdom was the primary designer of along with the European Union, he said. We can get there to a landing zone if we work in partnership. But you know, sabre-rattling and grandstanding in Westminster, ratcheting up the tensions is not the way to do it. Meanwhile, Britain's business secretary Kwasi Kwarteng said the United Kingdom had a right to act unilaterally contained within Article 16 of the Northern Ireland Protocol. Those sources close to Liz Truss have briefed that invoking Article 16 is not the route the government intends to take. Political stability in Northern Ireland is our number one priority, Kwasi Kwarteng told Sky News' Sophie Ridge. We should be able to act in a sovereign way. Northern Ireland is as much part of the United Kingdom as England, Cornwall, the South East, and we're responsible for that. Kwasi Kwarteng said he did not think there would ultimately be a trade war with the European Union, and that any imposition of tariffs would be likely to take considerable time. I don't think there is going to be a trade war. There has been a lot of talk, a lot of threats about what the European Union will or will not do. That is up to them, Kwasi Kwarteng told the BBC's Sunday morning programme. He added, as far as I'm concerned, our primary duty as the British government is to look after political stability in Northern Ireland. If that means re-looking at the Northern Ireland Protocol, we absolutely have to do that. I think this talk of a trade war is irresponsible, and I think it is completely getting ahead of ourselves. It is up to the European Union. We think it would be completely self-defeating if they went into a trade war, but that is up to them.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the U.S. economy destroyed U.S. production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This in turn is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Doctor, actually, on this point, if I may, with your permission, it's very interesting because you mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski. He actually states very clearly in his book, this was written in the late 20th century, he says that the worst scenario for America, he clearly states this, the worst scenario for America is an alliance between China, Russia, and Iran. So this is not some, like, when you are mentioning these things, when we in Iran talk about these things, these are not some sort of, you know, guesses. These are not some sort of conspiracy theories. These are things that are stated very clearly and openly by the leadership and by the elites in America. And so this is in terms of just, you know, complementing what you're saying, that, you know, it's clearly stated just as... It's very interesting for me because the things you mentioned, my specialty is strategic studies, international relations. Many of the things that you're mentioning are said, we talk about these things in strategic studies, in international relations, of course, in our own language, in our own jargon that we have. So, for example, you mentioned the British and their whole desire since the 19th century to destroy the Russian Empire. Well, again, this is clearly stated by Halford Mackinder, who is considered the father, or so-called the founding father of modern geopolitics and geostrategic studies. Of course, he was a geographer who for the first time looked at the world as one geostrategic unit and talked about the fact that whoever wants to rule the world has to control, of course, he used his own language, but what we would call today Eurasia, that if Eurasia on its own is so big and powerful and capable of... And if we look at historically, and, you know, I think there were economists in Holland that did a long-term study about this, which is that if you look at the global history, 80 to 90% of global history has been dominated in terms of the economic production and the center of civilization being in Eurasia, being in Asia. So this idea that somehow the North Atlantic or the Americans would dominate the world is actually a very strange and unusual situation that we had in human history. It's coming back to this situation where it was for centuries and for millennia. But you see people like Halford Mackinder clearly stating that their goal is to prevent any Eurasian power coming and becoming powerful and being a rival. And at that time, this is all in emphasizing the points you were making from a strategic studies perspective, that very clearly Halford Mackinder stating that the goal has to be that in no way, shape, or form should Russia and Germany be allied and be united, and that there has to always be a buffer zone. Between Germany and Russia, where they can exploit these petty nationalisms, where these countries can either be used against Germany or can be used against Russia. Anytime there's a danger that you would see Russia or Germany becoming powerful and then uniting in terms of strategically and economically, as you were mentioning, as was already happening in the end of the 19th century. The other thing that was very interesting for me, Doctor, was that actually there's serious people who would argue that the Americans, in a way, actually also had a ministry of industry that was controlling its industrial growth after World War II. It was just called the Pentagon. It wasn't called the Ministry of Industry. It was called the Ministry of Defense. So in a way, yes, they had those corporations that were, on paper, they were private. And they were, of course, private. The profits went to the oligarchs. It created an oligarchy in the United States. But its strategic coordination was done at the Pentagon. So things like the internet, things like mobile technology, mobile phones, all those technologies that we saw, you know, emerging out of the 20th century, if you trace a lot of them back, you see even things like civilian aircraft, civilian passenger flight. A lot of these things that were technologies that transformed the world technologically, if you trace back the money, you see that at some point they went back to the Pentagon and programs that were financed. And the reason is this, Doctor, and I'm so happy we're able to talk about these things on television, which is that very rarely do you have private investors willing to invest large sums of money for something that will be profitable in 10 or 20 years. This is just not something that a private investor will do. The horizon for profitability is maximum 4 to 5 years. And this is why, in reference to the new model that you are referring to in terms of the model that is being used in China or India, but also to a certain extent in Iran, which I will talk about a little bit with your permission. So what we need is, and this is exactly actually what happened in the US as well, which is that private companies were not willing to invest into technologies such as civilian airliners, such as those other advanced technologies, because it would have taken them 10, 15 years to get the profits. So the government comes in, gives them something called a government contract. This allows them to have profits and then take those profits for themselves or invest it into other areas. I think in Iran, we had a very similar experience as you were describing with China and India. Of course, I think, this is my personal view, is that the places where we made a mistake is where we sort of blindly imitated some of those bad habits that we see in the West in terms of financialing, making the economy more financial-based, not having those controls that they have in India and in China. So all this, what I want to sum up with is that a lot of the things that you are mentioning, which is very interesting, is exactly also things that in strategic studies and international relations we also talk about, of course, in our own language. And what we say in international relations or in strategic studies is that when those realities on the ground, those technologies, those real indicators of power and wealth, when they shift and the political institutions do not shift, that's when the conflict happens. So you have a reality in the world where the Americans bankrupted themselves pretty much by 2008, if you look at the financial crisis that happened in the United States. You had the so-called war on terror. I would just suggest this to you, Doctor, that actually the hybrid war, as far as the Iranians are concerned, has been going on since the 1990s. We've been experiencing all those elements that you describe as a hybrid war in Iran since the 1990s. Of course, because the scale of the conflict was smaller, maybe a lot of people in the world didn't realize this. Of course, those who were experts understood what the Americans were doing in Iran and in trying to fight Iran. All those elements that are now being used in this hybrid war against Russia and China were first used, tested, tried with Iran. And I think the interesting thing for maybe Russia and China is to look and to see how was Iran capable of resisting and not succumbing to this hybrid war. A lot of it, which of course you also indicated, which is to have that strategic management being centralized, but also taking advantage of market mechanisms and allowing both the forces that are social, but also the forces that are related to the central government being able to coordinate the different interests that exist. So with that in mind, I apologize. I just felt that there was it was very interesting to me. I wanted to add and emphasize some of the points you were saying from our perspective as strategic studies or international relations. So with that in mind, Dr. Ghazayev, what does the future look like? What is it, how is it that we're going to now move away from this system dominated by what is becoming an inefficient American system, a system that is abusing that system of banking and money, which was serving it for a purpose for a period of time, and weaponizing it and using it as a political tool and weapon against different countries. One thing that maybe we could talk about is the idea that, for example, why is it that we denominate all major important commodities in the dollar? I mean, Iran has a lot of oil and gas. Russia has a lot of oil and gas. Why do we have to sell it in dollars to India and China? We are neighbors. We're on the same continent. How is it that things like dollar hegemony and those other things that are the markers of the current system, what is the future going to look like? How can we replace these things that are currently existing with new systems, and what are those new systems going to be? And if you could please, we don't have a lot more time left, just if you could give us the gist of it.
To be brief, according to the long-term economic growth theory, it is quite clear that America is going to lose. It is no doubt that America will lose its leadership as well the British Empire lost it a century ago. Not because we don't like America, this is because America has obsolete and, in fact, inefficient economic system. They use their financial opportunities. They still have hegemony in the world of finance. Still, American dollar dominates in all transactions, which you mentioned, in the currency reserves. But it is very important that America lost its privilege to print the world money about 1 month ago. Of course, you're right that Iran is suffering from this hybrid war about 30 years. And of course, we had to look for the Iranian experience. Unfortunately, the Russian financial elite was very confident in the American state, in American policy, because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian economy becomes, in fact, the peripheral economy. It was used by the Americans as a donor. And by the Europeans, yes. We exported raw materials, and we had capital flight about $100 billion per year. And the Russian economy was too much dependent from the American influence, especially the governance of the Russian central banks was controlled by the IMF, and IMF recommendations were implemented in Russia with catastrophic results. But America was too much, it was too much concentrated on Russophobia, mm-hmm. and it played a bad joke with the Americans. They used their main weapon, the dominance in the world financial system against Russia, and they do not have any cards more. The American dollar is not considered as a reserve currency anymore in Asia. Of course, you have such experience before. For you, dollar is not reserve currency for a long time. But for Russia, and now for China as well, America, and for India, I am sure, American dollar lost its image as a world currency, and America so lost its main weapon, I should say. In this book, which I showed to you, I made some recommendations. They were written about, as I mentioned, 6 years ago. And the first recommendations was to, if you want to finish this war, if you want to save the mankind from the American aggression, we have to create coalition between those countries who are not interested in the war, who want peaceful development, and who are constructing now the new world economic mode. So we have to avoid to get rid from dollar. Get rid from dollar as a world currency in trade, in reserves, in financial transactions. For Russia and for Iran, it is no question anymore. It is no question also, I think, for China. And American superpower is undermined now because the world do not believe in American dollar anymore. And we have to move as far as possible for the national currencies in our relations. And now in our economic commission, we are trying to elaborate with the Russian academician experts, trying to elaborate the model for the new world currency. Mm-hmm. It should be based on the commodity basket. As you mentioned, Russia and Iran have dominance in the oil sector.
Exactly.
We also have dominance together in the metallurgy, in the chemical sector, in water, in coal, lot of commodities, we can organize the common economic space, which will be independent from the Western benchmarks. What we are thinking about to create the Asian exchange, mm-hmm. which will generate its own prices. prices should for all those commodities should not be generated in London or in New York. These are our commodities, and we can organize our economic space in such a way that the price formation for those commodities will satisfy our needs, not needs of the Western speculations, but the needs of the production sector.
Doctor, if I excuse me, so if I understand you correctly, we are looking maybe at a special international currency, not a national currency, but one that is backed by the national currencies and the commodities, and that so
yes.
is this correct? Did I understand this correctly? That yes, this would then be. Go ahead, please.
The idea is to create the new world currency, which could be used for the border transactions. This currency should be constructed on the basis of the basket of the national currencies mm-hmm. of those countries which are involved in this process, like a special development, special deposit rights of the IMF.
Yes.
But on the basis of the another principles, more fair and more clear. And another part of this currency should be the basket of commodities. If you combine together the basket of national currencies and basket of commodities and create the synthetic currency based on this about 30 subjects in the basket, we can go create a very a strong currency which will be very stable in spite of all the international conjuncture.
So excuse me, doctor, so let me understand you correctly. So this currency is not a currency that we in different countries would be having in our wallets, in our bank accounts. We would still be using our national accounts. This would be a purely international currency used for the transaction between countries for the sale of the commodities that exist, that it would be backed by the power of the national currencies and by the commodities that are so abundant in Asia. Which is interesting because you talked about fiat money. It's actually very, very new that we have fiat money. For throughout human history, we actually had commodity-backed money. We had money that there was something that people could back it with. So this is going back to that, in a certain way, going back to that.
Yes, but you are quite right. In international transactions, if you are speaking about the national economies, each country has its own national currency.
Very good.
Fiat currency, which can be used for monetary support of the investment activity. But the currency which I'm talking about is the currency for international transactions. Of course, we need some kind of organization like that. For instance, in BRICS, we have the basket of the reserve currencies of BRICS. We can involve BRICS countries as well, not only Asian countries, but let's take also Brazil and South Africa, use the BRICS organization. So the idea is to get rid from any kind of private monopoly on the world money. The new world money should be created on the basis of international treaty. This is the first foundation of the new economic world economic structure. The second foundation is the information technologies. As you know, the American agency of national security is the cyber terrorist number one in the world. Mm-hmm. Almost about half of cyber attacks are coming from the United States, from the one place, Agency of National Security. The United States is the only country which don't want to sign the International Treaty for Cybersecurity. So our peace coalition should also has another, not only monetary treaty, but also treaty on information technology, the Convention Against Cyber Terrorism. And those countries like the United States who doesn't want to sign this agreement and to fulfill this agreement should be under our sanctions. So we shouldn't use information technologies which are developed by the countries who sponsor the cyber terrorism, like the United States and Great Britain. This is the second foundation. And the third foundation, which becomes also very actual. As you know, the Americans is the only country in the world which openly violates the International Convention Against the Biological Weapons. As we have seen in Ukraine, the Americans were conducting the elaboration of the biological weapons using the Ukrainian population. So the COVID pandemic is also part of this biological war. Our coalition of the countries which want to finish this hybrid war and to create opportunities for the peaceful, sustainable economic growth, to my mind, should have three basic foundations. The first one is the Treaty Convention on the Issue and the World Money, which I described. The second one, the Convention Against Cyber Terrorism, which will regulate the use of information technologies in the world. And the third one, the Convention on the Control over the Fulfillment of the Convention on Biological Security. These are three foundations will be enough to create a very powerful worldwide coalition against American aggression. And I think here in Asia, we can be able to create new architecture, financial architecture, trade architecture of economic relations, which will be based on the mutual interests, which will be based on the international law, and which will be quite different from the liberal globalization led by Washington, because each country has its sovereign rights to elaborate those type of regulation of economy which is adequate to its cultural heritage, to the people's norms of behavior, and the diversity of the economic national systems is also the part of this new world economic mode. The main idea of international relations should be creation opportunities for the growth of investments, not trade liberalization, not currency liberalization, but creation of more opportunities for economic growth, for the growth of the well-being of societies, for the growth of the real incomes of the population. So I think together we can organize such kind of new economic mode, which will be attractive for the whole world.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much. We've run out of time, unfortunately. It was very interesting talking to you. And on that positive note, thank you so much. And hopefully, if there's opportunity arises, we can continue this discussion at a later time. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Glazev? If we look at the issue from the perspective of long-term economic cycles analysis, the era of U.S. economic power is coming to an end, and a new era of economic power based in Asia, particularly in China and India, is beginning because of more efficient production models that have been established there in recent years, combining centralized strategic planning with market forces and the channeling of profits into production as opposed to channeling them into the personal wealth of a few wealthy oligarchs. In contrast, the U.S. has shifted from a production-based economy to a financially dominated economy, characterized by extreme wealth gaps and the channeling of profits into the hands of a few oligarchs and into offshore tax havens, instead of into the expansion of production and jobs, an issue central to the Trump and America First campaign and presidency, and one of the keys to understanding the current social and political conflict that exists domestically in the U.S. We can add to this America's endless global war against terror that has been going on for more than 20 years and which has morally and infrastructurally bankrupted the U.S. with trillions of dollars spent on foreign wars, while basic needs and infrastructure are at a third world level in many parts of the United States. We can further add to this the fact that the Western-dominated global financial and banking systems are losing credibility, because of their weaponization by the U.S. to wage economic war against its global rivals and enemies, thus accelerating the emergence of a new non-Western global financial and banking system that allows countries to engage in trade and commerce outside of U.S. dollar.